Morning. You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. We're here in matter of S1, SC40395, State versus Kindred. Again, with petitioner Mr. Hart, you have 25 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Breon Kindred asked this court to vacate his conviction for first-degree murder and remand the case for a new trial for three reasons. First, that the district court committed reversible error when it refused to instruct the jury on the doctrine of imperfect self-defense. Second, that the district court abused its discretion in allowing into evidence lyrics from a rap song and music video, which he had published, as well as the audio of a Facebook Live video that included the use of the N-word. And third, that the district court abused its discretion when it failed to grant a mistrial, when the prosecutor misused the reasonable doubt standard during voir dire. To start with the imperfect self-defense instruction, this court has previously held in Abeita that there is the doctrine recognized under New Mexico law of imperfect self-defense. What the court has subsequently held, however, and the Court of Appeals has applied, is that imperfect self-defense is not an affirmative defense, and therefore the jury, a defendant in an imperfect self-defense claim, is not entitled to an instruction because that instruction comes by way of involuntary manslaughter. What Mr. Kindred asks in this case is that when we look at the evolving law of self-defense, and as self-defense becomes more complicated based on not only this court's case law, but other states around the country have recognized this, that the current definition of sufficient provocation that the courts have relied on in the past is just not a sufficient instruction that encapsulates this theory, the legal doctrine of imperfect self-defense.
Can we take a step backwards,
sure,
Mr. Hart? Defendant here was found guilty of first-degree murder, willful and deliberate. Imperfect self-defense could only serve to mitigate second-degree murder. So why are we here?
So we're here because the imperfect I see imperfect self-defense as the same as the failure to give a self-defense instruction. Because what we're doing here is we're depriving the jury of a key piece of the law that it needed when engaging in the analysis of whether this was a first-degree murder, a second-degree murder, or voluntary manslaughter.
But if the jury found that the defendant deliberated, which they did, that mens rea obviates imperfect self-defense. I mean, the jury said, no. We believe this is first degree and that there was deliberation. And so what does that do to us reviewing this case? You're asking us to set aside what the jury found under a proper instruction on first degree.
I think that it would be the same, Your Honor, if a jury found someone guilty of first-degree murder, would a court refuse to give a self-defense instruction? What we're asking here is not just that the doctrine of imperfect self-defense should have been instructed, but also that this court recognize that it's also an affirmative defense, right? So the court would have to make...
So you're now saying imperfect self-defense is an affirmative defense, like self-defense or voluntary intoxication? Even though it's part of the involuntary manslaughter instruction, whether we would include your proposed language or not?
So that's correct, Your Honor. There are two arguments that are made in the opening brief. The first is that the court should recognize that imperfect self-defense is an affirmative defense and revisit that line of cases that starts with Abeita and goes to Chavez in the Court of Appeals, but also then that that because it is an affirmative defense, that it requires an instruction for the court to make that determination.
So can I ask you why a new instruction would be needed or an additional one? under the UJI, sufficient provocation deals with, it specifically mentions the any action, conduct, or circumstances which arouse fear, terror, or other extreme emotions, and then it goes on and on. Why wouldn't those specific words address the imperfect self-defense instruction? Why do we need to add additional language or create a new instruction?
Because what 14222 does not have, Your Honor, is the discussion of when a defendant may have an unreasonable fear or act unreasonably because of this fear. And that is the difference between 14222 and imperfect self-defense, right, is that the voluntary manslaughter, and I think Justice Minsner accurately pointed this out in the concurrence in Jernigan, in saying that it doesn't completely encapsulate the specific facts that are present when someone raises imperfect self-defense during trial. So as the court said, 14222 only recognizes sufficient provocation as action, conduct, or circumstances which arouse anger, rage, fear.
So then our murder statute, section 32.1, which talks about first-degree murder and second-degree murder, subsection B says, unless he is acting upon sufficient provocation, upon a sudden quarrel, or in the heat of passion, a person who kills another human being without lawful justification, on and on, goes to second-degree murder. The legislature specifically indicated in the statute sudden provocation, sudden quarrel, or heat of passion, which is embodied in our jury instruction. If they intended for us to go further, wouldn't they have written it in the statute in 32.1?
I don't think that the language that's used in the statute precludes what we're asking for here, because like this court recognized in Abeta, we long have recognized, and the courts have long recognized, that the heat of passion includes the possibility of an unreasonable fear or an unreasonable belief that one need to defend oneself. And recognizing that doctrine without giving a defendant any way to use it specifically in a case like this, right, where I think the facts and circumstances in this case are unique, right? The element, the argument, and the facts that underlie the claim that Mr. Kindred made before the district court was this previous knowledge, these previous experiences of this man bragging about being in shootouts before, engaging in shootouts, always carrying a firearm, being quick to draw a firearm. That's different than the typical provocation in a voluntary manslaughter case, where we're looking for some type of action that's contemporaneous or, you know, has some type of connection to there. I mean, these are two, for all intents and purposes, strangers, right, who they have this one interaction at a music video shoot where Mr. Kindred witnesses this statement, right, and is told all of these things by other people. That evidence was introduced at the trial as evidence of Mr. Kindred's state of mind. And what the jury did not get in this case, and what Mr. Kindred was deprived of, was the ability to talk to the jury about whether that fear was reasonable or unreasonable, and if it was unreasonable, what that means under the law.
So, which is, it would be self-defense. Or is what you're arguing.
We argued self-defense, but he also, under the law, could have argued imperfect self-defense, that he was that his reaction to his fear was unreasonable, and he had.
I'm sorry.
No.
You finish.
I just said he had no way to introduce that legal principle to the jury if it's not instructed on it.
So, I'm thinking maybe two things. One, you're asking us to overrule Abeta. Two, you're asking us to say that you get an imperfect self-defense instruction, which, in the facts of this case, would translate into a perfect self-defense instruction. You're equating imperfect self-defense with self-defense, if I'm understanding your argument.
So
am I right on both points?
So you're right on the first point, that we are asking you to overrule part of Abeta, the part of Abeta that says imperfect self-defense is not an affirmative defense. I think on the second point, that's not what we're asking, because perfect self-defense would result in an acquittal. The affirmative defense there doesn't result in a lesser conviction. What imperfect self-defense results in is that it is a different at least under Abeta, a different definition of sufficient provocation. This is what Justice Minsner's concurrence in Jernigan talked about, is that the sufficient provocation definition doesn't neatly fit within the doctrinal definition of imperfect self-defense. So the argument would be to the jury is that it was self-defense, but if you find that his fear was unreasonable or that he acted with excessive force because of that fear, then those things are, the jury would be instructed, are sufficient for you to find provocation in a case. And that's what the jury...
And which results in an acquittal.
No, it results in a involuntary manslaughter. As voluntary manslaughter.
So you're basically wanting us to provide the alternative of sufficient provocation or imperfect self-defense.
Yeah, and I was thinking a lot about this one.
Right? How does that like play out?
We did our best at trial to kind of formulate some type of instruction here, but I was thinking prior today, and there are other ways to do it, such as, you know, having an alternative definition that goes in the voluntary manslaughter instruction, you know, that makes clear when the facts are present that also an unreasonable fear or excessive force, you know, an excessive response to fear in a self-defense case can also be sufficient provocation. So we're not asking that the court ignore the statutory definition of sufficient provocation. We're asking that the court's definition of imperfect self-defense, which is an additional way that provocation can be shown, that a jury be instructed on that.
So am I... I'm looking at State v. Chavez, paragraph 13, which you cite in your briefing. And it talks about to prevail on a claim of imperfect self-defense and reduce the gravity of the offense from second-degree murder to voluntary manslaughter. The accused reaction to the fear of death or great bodily harm, though unreasonable, must be a result of sufficient provocation. Is that basically what you're asking for? And, or are you saying, as even if, it seems to me you're saying, if you have elements one and two, you get involuntary manslaughter. Because you don't have element three, otherwise you'd be acquitted under self-defense.
I'm going a little bit further than Chavez, because what Chavez is really a picture-perfect Abeta case, where the court found that there wasn't sufficient facts to even give a voluntary manslaughter definition, right? And the Court of Appeals said, no, when we apply Abeta here, imperfect self-defense is one way that you could get voluntary manslaughter instruction. We're asking the court here to go a step further and recognize that imperfect self-defense can be an affirmative defense, right, to murder, and in doing so, that the jury has to be instructed on that actual doctrine.
Okay. So there would be no requirement of sufficient provocation in your affirmative in your proposed affirmative defense?
I think that the court in Abeta uses the word provocation.
Yes, right? And it does here too.
Right, and Chavez does as well. So, of course, there is... what is in there is provocation, but I view this as two different things. I view imperfect self-defense under Abeta as a definition of provocation where something could be voluntary manslaughter, right? This is an additional definition that this court has imposed, and that additional definition is what would be missing in just 14.222, right? If we just gave voluntary manslaughter and the provocation instruction. To move on to the evidentiary issues here, Your Honor.
So let me see if I'm understanding. So you're saying that provocation is something that the jury can consider to reduce murder, to justify murder, and reduce it to manslaughter.
Yes. That's what we were asking. Is that it be treated as an affirmative defense, like...
To justify the killing. Not to mitigate the killing, to justify the killing.
To mitigate.
Mitigate does not equate to an affirmative defense. Affirmative defense equates to justifying.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor.
I'm not saying that. I'm just giving you my understanding.
Brendan,
I'm trying to understand your argument.
I think that the best way to put our argument is we think that in this case, like the other states who recognize imperfect self-defense, is that what this court should do is recognize it as an affirmative defense that does not result in an acquittal, right? Because that is not what the doctrine in New Mexico or in any other state does. What it does is it recognizes that it is an affirmative defense to the element of intent, right, to the premeditation part, or in the intent portion of second-degree murder, that allows for it to be mitigated from some type of murder to the lesser homicide of voluntary manslaughter. And that is a change. We are not trying to say that this is what Abeta always said. Right, we are asking this court to conform its law with the other states.
But getting back to Justice Bacon's question, if the jury believes factually that you committed an imperfect self-defense, that results in an acquittal.
No. I don't.
I mean, I'm sorry. Let me think this thing through. If there is imperfect self-defense, that negates intent to commit first-degree murder.
Correct.
Which is an acquittal. You're perfectly free to argue those facts as a self-defense and say, because of these facts that occurred, I had no intent. But as Justice Bacon pointed out, your client was not convicted of manslaughter. It was convicted of first-degree murder with intent. So you're free to argue the facts under the existing instructions, if I'm right.
I partially agree with you, Your Honor. Yes, Mr. Kindred was allowed to argue the facts that he should be acquitted, and he did argue that before the jury. And he argued, based on the step-down instruction, for the alternative of second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. What he was deprived of the ability to do is explain to the jury, because it was not instructed on this area of the law, explain to the jury that this doctrine of imperfect self-defense has that mitigating element of negating intent to allow the jury to find that even if his fear was unreasonable or his response was unreasonable, that they may find voluntary manslaughter.
But isn't all of that belied by the fact that the jury here said, guess what, buddy? This was willful and deliberate. They didn't buy anything.
I disagree, Your Honor, because they didn't hear it. Because Mr. Kindred wasn't permitted to argue it. What we have right now is a legal doctrine that a jury is never allowed to hear.
Well, we got the sufficient provocation instruction that talks about fear and terror. And certainly it was well within defense counsel's purview to argue to the jury, well, both self-defense and why he could have argued imperfect self-defense under our existing jury instruction. Would you agree to the jury?
I don't agree, Your Honor.
Tell me why.
because what imperfect self-defense is, that the sufficient, that 14222 is not, is the discussion of unreasonable fear and the discussion of, even if you thought his fear was reasonable, was his response appropriate? So what the self-defense instruction says is that the fear has to be reasonable and the response has to be appropriate. It has to be related to the fear. The jury never gets that instruction under 14222. There's no way for a defendant in this case to come in and say, what the law says is that if you think that he acted unreasonably, given his fear, that may also be voluntary manslaughter.
Do you think he would be on a better... Would your argument hold more weight if he had been convicted of second-degree murder instead of first-degree murder?
I think that if the court rejects my request to revisit Abeta and say that this is an affirmative defense, then I also lose on the second part, as Justice Bacon is pointing out. In order for us to win, in order for us to say that the jury should have been instructed, the court also has to recognize this as an affirmative defense and not just as a legal alternative, you know, to provocation. Because the way a beta is that, you know, a second-degree murder can become voluntary manslaughter because this may be provocation. We're asking this court to go one step further as it relates to a beta. If the court rejects that request, which I think is in the second part of this section in our opening brief, then I agree that the court's decision should be that the jury doesn't get instructed on it. It has to also find that it's an affirmative defense. As for the evidentiary, well, I because of my time, Your Honors, jump over to the voir dire portion of this. So during voir dire in this case, the state engaged in a colloquy with the veneer where it talked about the, to use this campfire analogy, you know, would, and the specific questions that I asked the jury is equating this to reasonable doubt. You know, if we started a campfire, what would we need to do to know that that campfire would not result in a forest fire beyond a reasonable doubt? And it took all of these examples that it used, from having the fire department come out, to bringing water, to making it, you know, certain ways. What it did was it took this reasonable doubt standard that this court so vigorously protects, and it analogized it to these everyday activities in a matter which we think runs afoul of Montoya. And I think the question...
Wasn't the prosecutor simply trying to find out if he had reasonable people on the jury?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, that requires the court, and the district court made this finding, but that requires the court to completely ignore the question of how do you know beyond a reasonable doubt
that
the fire is
put out. But they never said reasonable doubt. They were only asking questions about what was reasonable to, as I understood it, explore whether the people on the jury were reasonable.
The prosecutor in this case certainly used the words reasonable doubt, and this even elicited the response from the veneer about percentages. Right, in this same conversation where they said, no, we don't talk about reasonable doubt by percentages, but the court still allowed the prosecutor to talk about reasonable doubt through this campfire analogy. And yes, the one question says reasonable and not reasonable doubt, but right before it and right after it and throughout this entire instruction, this entire colloquy that he's having with the jury, it's very clear that what the prosecutor is talking about to the state is reasonable doubt.
If that's so egregious, why was there no objection?
So what Mr. Kindred made the strategic decision to do was not draw more attention to this and to ask.
Why do his approach the bench?
So because it would require instructions. I mean, what he made the decision to, and we found these Second Circuit cases and other cases that state that for an objection to be timely to voir dire, it just needs to be made before the evidence is presented, right? And I believe what the court even stated on the record.
Isn't there all kinds of curative things that happen that you're, I mean, if you make the objection and you're going to do something curative, it's going to be to give the instruction on reasonable doubt. And the jury is instructed by the judge multiple times unreasonable doubt. So isn't that what's curative in and of itself?
I think that would require this court to deviate from Montoya. The jury is always instructed multiple times by the court on reasonable doubt. In every trial, it is mandatory. But if a defense attorney stands up in closing argument, he is prohibited, or she is prohibited, from making these arguments to the jury. And it is potentially, depending on what is said, a ground for a mistrial. The jury is instructed.
That's a closing argument. Very different than what I...
I don't agree that it's different, Your Honor, because there's also both shared this one thing of primacy, right? This is the very first thing that the jury sees. This is the very first time that the jury has these conversations, and it's actually before the court instruction. The court doesn't instruct it on reasonable doubt until much later on in the case, where at least when there is a closing argument, the ability to influence the jury there is at least immediately mitigated by a definition of reasonable doubt. But the primacy of the two, I think, is what this court recognizes in Montoya and why it should extend to voir dire, is because any time that we deviate from this standard, any time that it is improperly discussed with the jury, we run the risk of the most crucial part of a criminal trial, the most crucial protection under due process, being undermined.
Is there any chance the state was discussing that in the context of, is it reasonable to fatally injure someone that stole your moped or e-bike or whatever it was? Reading the record, I know you want to tie it to a reasonable doubt standard, but to Justice Vargas's question, could they equally been inquiring about whether what a jury finds reasonable?
And may I answer,
yeah,
Your Honor? So I think there are two responses to that. The first is you could take the prosecutor's words for it. In the argument over the mistrial motion, he said that I have, in many trials, used this explanation of reasonable doubt to ask the jury about whether, you know, about its understanding of reasonable doubt. The other is, I think there's a difference between saying to the jury, taking a factual statement from the case and testing to the jury, you know, would you still be fair? Would you be able to make a decision knowing this fact? Would you be able, you know, to, you know, give, to follow the instructions of the court, which is something that we all do with the facts of the case, versus having a conversation and giving a definition, you know, of reasonable doubt that directly conflicts with this court's rulings and the UJI.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll hear from the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have 30
Tessa
minutes.
Ryan for the state. May I please
proceed?
The court?
Yep.
This is not like most homicide cases where the jury has to piece together what happened. This killing was captured on surveillance camera video, and the jury, like you, and we can watch that video to see what happened. Anyone who watches that video will see, wasn't a grainy video, it was pretty clear, still daylight out, will see that in the approximately 6 seconds from the time the victim noticed the defendant approaching from behind him, having caught him by surprise, the victim didn't touch a gun, didn't reach for a gun. He, frankly, didn't do anything to defend himself or to provoke this shooting. The defendant came up from behind, like I said, shot him 4 times, and the victim fell to his death in a matter of seconds. So in the face of these basic immutable facts, the defendant is seeking reversal of his conviction for first-degree murder. But to succeed, as you know, he's got to do 2 things. First of all, show that there was an error of some kind below. And second, show that the error is the reason the jury found him guilty. And he does not succeed in doing either of these. I'll move into the issue that hasn't been touched on, the abuse of discretion of the district court, or claimed abuse of discretion, on the admission of 2 pieces of evidence, one being a clip from lyrics he wrote, or someone wrote, that he rapped, and then the second being an audio clip from a Facebook Live upload. Okay. Starting with the decision to admit these pieces of evidence, why was this not an abuse of discretion? First of all, the district court held hearings and discussion on this issue for on three different days. One was on a hearing for a motion in limine, the second on the first day of trial, both in the morning and the afternoon, and then third on the second day of trial, also morning and afternoon. Throughout these deliberations, the court sought input from the parties, gave the parties time to research case law on the issues. used her own breaks, lunch hour, and even weekend to do independent research and read materials that had been provided to her and that she had independently looked up. She also offered tentative rulings, kind of giving the parties a sense of where she was inclined to rule and letting them do some more exploration into why that would not be a good ruling. She offered to reconsider rulings after she'd already made them. Another reason why this was not an abuse of discretion, the vast majority of both of these items were excluded. So in the case of the Facebook Live post, which lasted close to 27 minutes, she allowed in only 30 seconds of that clip. In the case of the lyrics, she struck the audio entirely and the video entirely. She said that only statements would be appropriate here. She was very concerned about potential prejudice to the defendant. She then, on that one, revised her ruling, having reflected further. She took out some a line of the lyrics that dealt with something about the defendant, what he did when he was a juvenile. And in that case, she excluded the N-word entirely. She said that it could be inflammatory when characterized through someone else. Another reason this wasn't an abuse of discretion, several times she expressed the desire to get this right. She said, for example, in the case of Facebook Live question, it comes down to discretion. There's just no authority on point. But I always want to be right, especially when it's this important and it implicates the defendant's right to a fair trial. And I'm quoting loosely. These are not her exact words necessarily, but roughly what she said. She said, also in that context, I've really tried to arrive at the right result. And she says, it's important to put in the time and effort to get the right ruling. That's the best I can do with the two issues and what we know about the facts of the case here. Another reason this wasn't an abuse of discretion, she found in both cases probative value to the substance of what was admitted and a nexus to the case, all the while having considered prejudice. So in the case of the lyrics, she was the one who proposed the idea of excluding portions of them because she was concerned about prejudice. She said that it needs to be narrowly tailored, and whatever does come in has to have a factual similarity to the charges. There was an argument, in her words, well taken, that visuals and content is highly prejudicial and could be highly inflammatory to the jury. I balance that with what the state says, which is that this is valuable as having corroborative implications and as motive or admission. She also commented, there appears to have been a nexus, a tie to the allegations of this case. I understand there's a difference between the actual shots, the number of shots fired, but there is some similarity. And she commented that this has been taken down to a skeletal version of what has relevance here. The statements are indicative of the intent specific to this case. And she pointed out to the defense that there can be ample cross-examination on dates and facts, the fact that there was another producer, artist, etc. And she would let that determination be made by the jury because it was a question of fact. In the case of the Facebook Live clip, the district court was very concerned about the use of the N-word. So that's the kind of big thing here. She acknowledged it could be inflammatory, and it was the reason she redacted it from the lyrics. But she said, in this case, I'm a firm believer that we shouldn't over-sanitize to the point actual facts are lost. We can't mislead the jury or change the facts of the case. That said, I have real concerns about the N-word and what it does to inflame people. I don't want to be in a position where the jury isn't focusing on content, but rather being inflamed by words that could be characterized as hateful in nature in any way. So the question is, why did she keep that word in on the Facebook Live clip? Basically boils down to three reasons, the first being her recognition that based in part on the authority the defense had provided, there was a distinction between saying this word using the hard R and saying it as more colloquially in the case of the soft R, the first one being a racial epithet. The second being the defendant using this in his own words, conversationally. She points out there's a difference between telling the jury it was the colloquial use of the soft R N-word and the hard R N-word. I don't want to tell the jury he's saying something he isn't. What was helpful was two cases provided by the parties. They had given her some cases to review. One of them discusses the difference between, as I just pointed out, the racial epithet when it's used as hate speech, which is very prejudicial, and when it's not used as racial epithet, instead as a colloquial pronoun, kind of like the word dude, used to define a person. There's a big distinction in her words. Not used as an epithet here because it's being used by the defendant to refer to himself. To somehow limit the jury's understanding gives me concern that we'd be creating even more prejudice. She pointed out that this is more like a podcast. It's the defendant's thoughts and words. And she saw a difference between dealing with the rap video, which, arguably gave the jury ideas about the type of person the defendant was, versus this, which was akin to a podcast. In this case, he was not referring to himself as a rap artist. A second reason for this being, relevant and coming in, actually having less prejudicial value than claimed, is that to redact would have potentially been more prejudicial than to not redact. It would require the jury to speculate about what was being said. And if the jury was simply told that it was the N-word, they might have thought it was the hard R, not the soft R version of that word. So she did, in a concession of sorts, offer to redact and spell out the word, but the defense rejected that offer. Third reason is that there would have been possible confusion and need for fact-finding if the word was redacted. So she says, it's always concerning. I don't want that word in the courtroom. I don't want something inflaming the jury. But when I look at the construction of that paragraph, the word is used interchangeably to refer to various individuals. It becomes something left to the finder of fact about who he's referring to. I don't want to get into a position where I'm making a determination about the facts. She pointed out that the defendant was using this word to refer to potentially three individuals, like I said, himself being one, neighbors on the street or other people, third party being another, and the person who stole his bike as a third. And she points out that the language is extremely important. So, to anyone's, if you have a question about why did she not do what she did in the first case, simply have the detective read the words spoken by the defendant as opposed to letting this play as a clip for the jury. She said that the audio has evidentiary value. There's no reason to limit it. She thought it was less prejudicial to hear the actual terminology because it's very clear. And he's not using the word as a racial epithet. On the subject of why this came in, what probative value did it have? Deliberate intent, as you know, was an issue. Murder in the first degree was charged, as was second degree. It helped establish the defendant's intent in committing this killing. And that was a question the jury had to decide. They were relevant, these particular statements, because the bike was stolen and it was about someone being in fear, being around him, and that is, she said, relevant to this case. So she found that it was relevant. As you know, I don't have to tell you this, but I will remind you that the abuse of discretion standard, which is what we are looking at here, is highly deferential to the district court's ruling. It would have to be clearly against the logic and effect of the facts and circumstances of this case, and I hope I've impressed on you the fact that the district court here did not take this ruling lightly. She gave it a thorough consideration, a lot of deliberation on the subject. She didn't make her ruling rashly or impulsively. It was well considered. She was being very conscientious. The determination is fact-sensitive, so that's another reason there's more deference given to the district court to fairly weigh the probative value against the probable dangers. And lastly, just as a reminder, when there are reasons both supporting and detracting from a trial court decision, there is no abuse of discretion. In case you were to find that this was somehow error, I would urge you to look at the fact that it would be harmless error. This really can't realistically have affected the verdict. You take back to the first point I started with, the fact that this murder was captured on video and the jury found that the defendant had committed first degree murder, it's quite clear that, you know, that is the reason they found the defendant guilty, not because of any prejudice they might have held or any passions that were enlivened because these lyrics in this clip came in. I will quickly touch on the issue of reasonable, the prosecutor's use of the word reasonable during voir dire, just to say that the reason the court did not grant the mistrial, which again is subject to the abuse of discretion standard, I'll give you those reasons. She observed there was no objection from the defendant until well after questioning was over, and she said that if it had been a timely objection, she would have talked about it. She also pointed out that the state was not quantifying the standard, putting numbers to what is a reasonable doubt or the likelihood that something happened, but was simply asking the jurors what they thought reasonable doubt was. And then the prosecutor transitioned onto another subject. Ultimately, she said the state didn't provide a definition contrary to law or an example that would misstate the law. This too, however, was, as you've, I think, observed, harmless, because there was really no way the jury was confused as to what standard actually controlled. This happened during voir dire at the very beginning. And at the end of trial, the court read the UJI definition of beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard. The state also read the jury uniform jury definition. So the jury heard it twice from the court and the state. And in addition, the jury was given the written definition of that standard.
Are we looking at harmless error? Are we looking at fundamental error? Because if the objection is untimely such that the court was not given an opportunity to rule on it, it really becomes a preservation issue. And if it's a preservation issue, isn't it fundamental error as opposed to harmless error?
You can have kind of both, I think. I mean, sure, it wasn't objected to on time, so it would presumably be subject to the fundamental error standard. Although, again, I would point out, we really don't have an error, and she did not.
I'm just trying to get the law right.
Sure. But yes, even if it were considered fundamental error, if it rose to that level, then there'd be a question about whether it was harmless.
Thank you.
And I think it can be safely said that this being a 5-day trial, with these comments having, you know, been heard by the jury at the very beginning, well, before it even officially began, there's no real way to say that this stuck in those people's minds enough to have influenced their verdict. I will quickly touch on the jury instruction issue. Just to point out, I think, you know, the simple way to approach this, which I think you've recognized to some extent at least, if not completely, is that we have a beta saying that since 1917, imperfect self-defense has been adequately covered under our jury instructions on manslaughter. And this court, said then, in 1995, we see no reason to change our jury instructions to accommodate a new phrase covering a legal concept that has long been part of New Mexico law.
So do you think, and they're asking us to overturn Aveda, but do you think, seems to me what, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong, defense counsel's arguing is when element three of self-defense is not met, the jury isn't given an opportunity to consider the situation where a defendant's reasonably in fear, but their response to that fear is unreasonable. Like, that's not spelled out in the sufficient provocation definition.
I think that's because that is what we call murder. If your fear is unreasonable and your reaction is unreasonable, that's nothing that...
No. I said they're reasonably in fear. The fear is reasonable, yes. But the response is unreasonable.
I thought that's what I heard. That's voluntary manslaughter.
And so that's what I'm asking you. Do you think that the current instruction covers that situation sufficiently, and why or why not?
Yes, I do. I have it here. Okay, so the instruction says we've got someone killing the victim. The defendant knew his acts created a strong probability of death or great bodily harm. I don't think that's what we're talking about. The third element is that the defendant acted as a result of sufficient provocation. Sufficient provocation is defined as can be any action, conduct, or circumstance which arouse anger, rage, fear, sudden resentment, etc., extreme emotions. The provocation must be such as would affect the ability to reason and to cause a temporary loss of self-control in an ordinary person of average disposition. So that's somebody who is not unreasonable. And when that provocation causes the killer to react and commit murder, that is kind of losing my train of thought. Your question was whether that element is met here, or whether...
Well, I'm trying to rephrase probably, and I'm sure he'll let me know. What I heard him say, I believe, was the current definition of sufficient provocation doesn't adequately cover imperfect self-defense, even though we've used it kind of interchangeably for decades now. And I think he said it's because a situation where element three of self-defense is not met completely. In other words, the defendant is reasonably in fear, but his response to that fear was unreasonable.
And that's voluntary manslaughter. We've got case law saying that that's voluntary manslaughter.
So you don't think an additional definition is needed?
I think
the question is, how does the jury know that's voluntary manslaughter?
They don't need to know. You know, the courts instruct them on what the law is. They simply follow the instructions. The instructions have to comport with the law.
And it leads them to the path of voluntary manslaughter?
Yes,
when they
it
found
would.
That they were in fear, but it was not they did not act reasonably?
Is the fear, Your Honor, in your scenario, is the fear reasonable?
They were in fear, but they did, yes, but they did not act reasonably.
That's voluntary manslaughter, yes.
And how does the jury know that? Where's the instruction that leads them to that place?
Okay. That is back to the defendant acted as a result of sufficient provocation. We have, I suppose it's case law that says that when a person is provoked sufficiently and exercises excessive force, that is considered voluntary manslaughter. It's our case law saying that. I don't know how else to put this in that, you know, what he's proposing does not comport with the law. You cannot have an unreasonable fear and an unreasonable excessive use of force.
I don't think that. I think he was saying a reasonable fear, but an unreasonable response to the fear. Which is what you're saying is sufficient provocation, I believe.
I'm saying I believe that's voluntary manslaughter.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, back to what I was saying. You know, this can get complicated. I realize it's sort of also a moving target in some sense because the instruction that was proposed said both unreasonable fear and, well, rather, it said sufficient provocation. So it's in itself a bit of a contradiction. I think you would need to both overrule Abeita, redefine sufficient provocation, do all kinds of things which would, in the end, in this case, in this context, really be unjustified, because you can't really look at this case, the facts of it, and say that this can possibly be tolerated by our...
Is there anything in the way the instructions were given that would prohibit defense counsel from arguing for voluntary manslaughter?
He got the voluntary manslaughter instruction.
Is there anything in the way the instructions were structured that would prevent defense counsel or hinder defense counsel from arguing voluntary manslaughter?
Of course not, no. He was able to argue that there was sufficient provocation, and that is what he tried to argue. That the victim reached for his gun. In the defendant's words, he went for it. I will just briefly, since as the appellee in the case, the state does not have an opportunity other than here to respond to any points made in the reply brief. I'd like to just touch on a few of those. Beginning on page 1, the defendant makes the claim that Chavez says that imperfect self-defense, this is his quote, imperfect self-defense occurs when the accused's reaction to the fear of death or great bodily harm, though unreasonable, is the result of sufficient provocation. What that really says is that to prevail on a claim of imperfect self-defense and reduce the gravity of the offense from murder to voluntary manslaughter, the accused's reaction to the fear of death or great bodily harm, though unreasonable, must be the result of sufficient provocation. Moving on to page 2, Jernigan, which was brought up earlier, I would like to point out that there's a lot of reliance in this by defense counsel on this dissent by Justice Mintzner. What she was dissenting to was that in that case, the Supreme Court held that an attempted voluntary manslaughter instruction should have been given. And so the case was reversed for that reason. She disagreed. It should not have been given. And in her discussion on this subject of imperfect self-defense, she cited a law review article recognizing something that was pointed out in the answer brief here, which is that instructions cannot change the statutory definition of voluntary manslaughter. The responsibility rests with the legislature. The homicide law in New Mexico should be revised to resolve the contradiction in the murder-manslaughter scheme. So even she is recognizing, indirectly, but she is, that what would need to happen for this to change somehow is for the legislature to weigh in. Again, this isn't about what other states do and say. This is New Mexico, and this court is bound by the statutes our legislature has created, the defenses, the precepts it puts forth. On page 4, the claim going to the relevance of the lyrics is that there is no evidence that Mr. Kindred knew that King had stolen the bike before he saw King with it and announced a plan to kill King through those lyrics. The claim is that the facts don't match the lyrics. Just to be clear, the state never alleged that the defendant planned to kill King himself. The prosecutor argued that it was motive and plan before the incident, an allegation, a retaliation for stealing the bike. So in other words, just so you know, this isn't necessarily brought out very clearly, but there is an exhibit, which was the defendant recording himself on Instagram, reciting these same lyrics that later appeared in the video. So the Instagram recording is, or upload, was on the 15th of June. The incident occurred on the 27th of June, and the videos were posted after that, one on the 17th to YouTube and one on the 25th to Facebook. So again, it's not just motive, but deliberation, some contemplation that the defendant would seek revenge, retaliation against whoever it was who stole his bike, and not necessarily Mr. King himself. On page 5, we have another reference to the N-word being, quote, the most noxious racial epithet, but as I pointed out earlier, the district court found it was not used here as a racial epithet. On page 6, on the subject of harmless error, the claim is that it is well established that the state bears the burden of proving that an error is harmless, but that's a quote of Toyardo is the case cited for that proposition. I'd just like to point out that the full line that's not quoted completely is whereas here, this is in Toyardo, a constitutional error has been established, the state bears the burden of proving the error is harmless. So what defense is leaving out is constitutional error. This here was not constitutional error. On page 7, we have the line, whether the shooting was premeditated or in self-defense was the only issue at trial. That is not true. Second-degree murder and voluntary manslaughter were also issues. And on pages 7 and 8 of the reply brief on the subject of reasonable, I just want to be clear that the state never said, as is suggested there, never said or used the word negligence. The prosecutor only said beyond a reasonable doubt. I believe he said that twice. To close, the resolution of this case should be pretty straightforward. We have video evidence of first degree killing and no indication that the district court erred in any way. In addition, and mainly because of that video, none of the so-called error could possibly have influenced the verdict, so the state therefore asks this court to affirm it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Petitioner, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. To start with where the state left off as far as the voir dire, the argument is not that the prosecutor used the word negligence or discussed negligence. What the argument here is that the only standard that occurs in these cases is beyond a reasonable doubt. When we're talking about reasonableness, especially when it is bookended by the statement of reasonable doubt both before the question and after the question, we're not talking about whether a person is a reasonable person. We're talking about reasonable doubt. There is no other standard in this case. For the imperfect self-defense, Justice DeMora, you are correctly stating my position, which is that the statutory definition that we have here and the definition that the jury is instructed on of sufficient provocation does not include any language to allow the jury to determine what happens if there is a reasonable fear but an unreasonable response. And that is what our proposed jury instruction at least attempted to do, where we stated, if you find that there was an appearance of an immediate danger of death or great bodily harm, but find that Mr. Kendrick did not act as a reasonable person in the same circumstances would have reacted, then you may find that there was imperfect self-defense.
What was your client's reasonable fear?
So,
I'm pointing this out because you have cited nary a reference to the record in your statement of the facts. So I don't know what you're relying on to say that he had a reasonable fear.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. We did. What we talked about in the statement of facts and what was the reasonable fear at trial was that prior to encountering Mr. King on that night, he had overheard.
He thought he was a bad dude. That's what you're saying was the reasonable fear.
I mean, it's more than just he thought he was a bad dude. He heard Mr. King talk about the fact that he has engaged in shootouts and, you know, he shoots first and that he had bullets still inside of him, which ended up being true. By the evidence, so there is some corroboration of that statement. And also, Mr. Kindred testified that some person that, you know, he, within the neighborhood, you know, he was told by other people that Mr. King was dangerous and that Mr. King always had a firearm on him, which also ended up being true. He had a firearm cross-holstered on him with a bullet in the chamber, right? So that evidence was what the court found was the kind of prima facie case, for lack of a better term, of fear, that a jury could find that there was a reasonable fear that he was in danger when approaching him. What we do not know and cannot know because of the way the jury was instructed is, did the jury feel that the fear was not reasonable, or did the jury feel that his response to that fear was unreasonable? That's where we think there is the error in the instruction and what is not encapsulated in the sufficient provocation instruction. And I believe that one of the things the government, that the state said in its argument, is the jury doesn't need to know. We just strenuously disagree. The jury should be instructed on all of the law that is applicable to the facts of a case. And here they were not instructed on a very important area of the law. As for the evidentiary issues, the abuse of discretion standard is not a good faith standard. There's no argument here that the district court, Judge Moran, did not put all the effort that she could have and try to make the right decision. What the argument here is, the abuse of discretion is that it is against the logic and effect of the case to equate a song or an artistic expression with a statement of motive or a statement as some type of confession, because I don't think that it is a surprise that really where this comes up is two instances, where we have cartel songs or where we have rap songs, and where it comes up is almost exclusively within communities of color. The difference between this case and a case where a cartel song may happen is we have evidence and testimony that says they are talking about what they did. Here, we are taking a man's artistic expression as a musician, and I'm sorry, may I just finish? A person's artistic expression, both within his persona that was present on the Facebook Live and within this song, and taking that artistic expression and turning it into evidence against him as motive and premeditation. And that is what we believe is against the logic of this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. In the matter S1SC 40395, State versus Kindred, this matter is deemed submitted. The court is in recess until 1:30 this afternoon. I call it the clerk.